Good evening, good evening. This is Veronica Entwistle, and you've tuned in to Paradigm Shifters. So who's a paradigm shifter? Maybe you are. Paradigm shifters are people who are making a difference in the collective these days. Really is a very rapid quantum shift going on in human consciousness on the collective level. And there are some people that are really aiming that wave, making it go very fast. And today's guest is Aravinda. Aravinda is really having an impact on many people with his goals of enlightenment and illumination and tracking his cellular lineage, really by following it all the way through to a very precious community of ascended beings that are hidden in the Himalayas. But I just went to a seminar of Aravinda's, and we talked a lot about what it takes to be enlightened. Is it just for the special people? What are some of the blocks we have to transcend to be enlightened? And he talks to us about the various steps that you can take to feel the freedom of your own innate enlightenment and illumination. I'm here on site on Orcas Island. Oops, and here comes Aravinda. So let's tune in to what he has to share today. So my guest is here right now on wonderful Orcas Island. My guest today is Aravinda. Welcome.
Thank you.
Good. I'm glad you're here. I had a wonderful time at your seminar. And I'd love to talk to you about, for example, we'll start right at the top, is your, I don't know if we call it definition, what is enlightenment?
Well, it's not typically what people think it is. There's quite a few definitions. Some people think enlightenment is something that you get from education. Or some people think enlightenment is something that occurs when you merge with God. But the truth of enlightenment is that it's something that we already have. It's not something that we have to attain. In fact, in the process of trying to attain something, we enter a kind of pursuit. And the pursuit in itself, just understanding the word itself, represents a kind of separation. So as long as we're in pursuit,
there's a tension in pursuit, isn't there?
There's a tension in pursuit. You know, the tension is essential to life. We need tension in life, but we don't need a tension of separation or an affirmation of separation to be able to bring about an experience of enlightenment. And there's so many myths about enlightenment in our world today. And a lot of those myths were actually perpetuated over the last 50 years. And many of them came from the East, of all things. You wouldn't think that would be the place where they came from. Because in many ways, our definition of enlightenment that we have in general comes from the East. As you know, some of the Westernized religions don't really recognize an enlightenment. They always have
sort of an atonement process, usually.
Yeah, perhaps if you're a very good person and you've done everything just right and you've been able to make yourself perfect in life, then you get to go to heaven. If not, well, you know, it's unfortunate. And the truth is that there's no such thing as perfection. Not in this world. That's a myth. If there was perfection, we wouldn't be able to function.
So enlightenment isn't perfection.
Enlightenment is not perfection. You in general, all beings, in essence, in their quintessential nature, are perfect. But in life, in incarnation, they're not meant to be perfect. Mm-hmm. It's not possible to have a relationship with the One. It's not possible to have a relationship with the One if you are perfect. Because perfect in itself suggests everything is complete.
Mm-hmm.
Every being is whole, absolute.
And we hear that all the time, that we're whole and complete as we are.
It's true. We are whole and complete as we are in our quintessential nature. But inside that wholeness, there are the parts.
Mm-hmm.
There are the individuals, the incarnations. And in order for the one, which we refer to as whole, to have relationship, it has to have some defined moment in time that something appears, and that something is you.
Mm-hmm.
That it's the one becoming self-aware, maybe in this planet, in 6 billion forms. And so when that consciousness of that individual becomes self-aware and gives up all resistance to what it is aware of, it goes into a process that being becomes, enters a process of becoming self-realized. Now that can take forever. There's no end to that.
So let's use the word resistance and have an example, because I'm just thinking, okay, resistance is when I think to be a good person, I have to do this and this. There's a resistance in that. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, in a sense, yeah, I think that we could look at it that way. When I say, when I'm referring to resistance, when I talk about resistance, I think more in line of resistance to the truth, because we're defending something. Mm-hmm. We're defending some kind of an idea about who we are, some kind of relationship to ourselves.
Well, you talked about that this weekend, and I really felt like in many ways, so many of us, and me particularly, mm-hmm. are always defending something.
We are, and that's fundamentally the reason that we find ourselves unenlightened.
Mm-hmm.
That was
a shocking discovery for me.
It is. You know, our Western world tells you, get in touch with who you are. Find out who you are. Define yourself. But that's actually the model for illness. Every illness that we have, every struggle, every pain, all the misery, all the suffering is based upon the idea of being someone.
Mm-hmm.
Because as soon as you become someone, as soon as you identify with something that's created, if it's a good person, a bad person, worthless, great, you know, any definition, any aspect of our polar definitions that we can apply, the moment we do that, we have to either affirm it or defend it.
Okay.
See, it's a natural thing. Our mind is an instrument of service. Mm-hmm. It's a mental instrument of service. All of its functions are oriented towards serving some master. And that master can't be defined.
Mm-hmm.
But in the process of seeing all this coming into play, what we see, our bodies, our idea of who we are, our personalities, the things that we form ourselves, our lives around, it's all based on an identity. And when we
and
have
the identity
that,
is something we might be seeking as opposed to being.
Exactly. Being has a natural shine to it.
Mm-hmm.
Just a pure natural state of being has a natural shine to it.
Mm-hmm.
If we let that shine be without interfering with it, with our attachments or aversions, our need to affirm something, our prejudices, our predilections, if we don't interfere with it, if we don't fear with the natural shine of our own consciousness, then we actually begin to approach enlightenment. But as long as we're trying to either be someone, including trying to be enlightened, we're actually standing in our own way.
Hmm.
Enlightenment is the simplest form. It really is the simplest form. But people say, well, if I'm just passive then, if I just sit back, can I be enlightened? No, there's much more to it than that.
Sounds like you're saying we need to be enshrined.
We do. We need to be enshrined because that's what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
See, we have a perceiver, an essential perceiver. We understand the essential perceiver now because quantum physics or physics will affirm it for us.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is rooted in an essential perceiver. But most people don't understand what that is.
But the perceiver actually changes the reality.
Well, the perceiver is constantly unfolding it. But it's an instantaneous, immediate present dreaming that is happening. It's the face of the universe rolling forward into time.
Hmm.
And we all participate in that as individuals. Now, imagine that this every individual...
Are we reacting against it?
Well, we're reacting against it when we resist it in some way by defending or affirming who we are.
Hmm. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, that's exactly right. If we are in a kind of inner defense of this idea of ourselves, we actually interfere. And those are called distortions. You know, in the East they would call those kleshas or vrittis or samskaras, which means shadows or tendencies, habitual tendencies that we've learned over this lifetime and former lifetimes and so on, or in our childhood. Whatever we've done to try to create this idea of ourselves. Now, you've seen it. You've seen somebody... Many, many times. As soon as a person is threatened, you say something to somebody and it doesn't fit into their model of who they think they are, they'll fight for that.
Mm-hmm.
People are so adamant about that that oftentimes it's more frightening to lose their identity than their lives themselves.
Hmm.
This is why sometimes we see suicides. They lose their sense of their world, their reality, and they've got nothing left to live for. And that's just sort of the ultimate depiction of illusion, right?
Mm-hmm.
There, you know, and this is constantly happening. Now, on the other hand, if we were able to find a way to simply let it be,
mm-hmm.
to let go, and learn to listen rather than to affirm, rather than to try to create a conclusion with our consciousness, be in a constant receptivity. So we need some fundamentals, some basic fundamentals. And illumination doesn't happen without these fundamentals present. They're the simplest of fundamentals. It starts in sincerity.
Okay.
If we could just learn to be sincere. We all know what sincerity is. We can't quite define it, but we know what it is. We need to be honest. We don't know what that is. It's just telling the truth, but what is telling the truth? We can't tell all the truth at once. So that means like we have to allow something to occur that we essentially know, don't think, know is true. Now, we don't have to defend the truth. You know, when we're defending the truth, you know something's wrong because we're in doubt. So mm-hmm. we don't know it. But knowing something is closer to something else. It's closer to faith. It's something inside of us that faith is a knowing. And it's a shine. It's something that's always there. Just like your enlightenment is essentially always there. Mm-hmm. Even if it's buried under layers of illusion, it's always there, waiting for that moment, that one day to be able to emerge mm-hmm. into expression. And some people have this imagined idea that one day they will be enlightened. But what they have to imagine with is only all of that which what they've learned. See, if the people already knew what enlightenment was, then they already would be there. Mm-hmm. But they don't. So we can't affirm an enlightenment. We have to listen for it. So we have to return to innocence, willingness, receptivity. See, humility. Humility is such a big word. Mm-hmm. It means anything's possible. Instead of, this is possible. The arrogant mind says, this is who I am.
Well, humility can be interpreted by some people as you got very weak and you're really humble when you should have been standing up for yourself.
Yeah, that's a fairly classic example. I'm smaller than. But the true definition of humility is anything's possible. I give up my arrogance and think only this is possible. Arrogance is a fixed, narrow vision of reality. Humility is an open-ended willingness to see anything. Mm-hmm. I don't have to be right. All I have to do is listen purely, innocently. So that's a foundation, an extremely important foundation. See, if I was to say, what can you do? Mm-hmm. What can you do to be able to bring yourself to enlightenment the quickest? Have compassion for yourself. Just compassion.
That's a pretty hard one for some people at times.
I think it's especially hard because people don't really know what it means. They may say, I should be sympathetic? Should I be empathetic? Those are different definitions. They have nothing to do with compassion. You see, compassion isn't feeling sorrow. Mm-hmm. Compassion is being present. It's an art. It's perhaps the highest art in the spiritual path.
Mm-hmm.
It means that you're able to see whatever is in your life at any one moment in time. Any shadow that presents itself, any angst, any suffering, any misery, including anything that's making you feel good, you can take it into your awareness fully. To acknowledge it. See, that's when you have sincerity, when you have willingness, when you have receptivity, when you have this place of being able to say, I can listen purely without interfering, you can acknowledge something. That's the foundation for compassion. But, you know, there are old traditions that always said, karuna. Karuna is the foundation for spiritual. Karuna means compassion. And so if you have that, and you have this ability to look at life the way it is, I mentioned it this weekend to you. I said there's an old word that in Sanskrit is called santosha. And santosha has always been misinterpreted as contentment.
Mm-hmm.
And people say, well, if you're content with life, then you're okay. But being content in santosha means something more. It means being able to be with what is. But that doesn't mean you're finished.
Mm-hmm.
Contentment doesn't mean santosha, that kind of contentment, doesn't mean you're finished. It just means that you have opened your awareness to the possibility of seeing what is without resisting it.
What if somebody attacks you? Let's just bring it right down to earth here.
Well, if somebody attacks you physically or emotionally?
Anyway, let's say emotionally because that's probably more likely right now.
Well, if somebody was to attack you emotionally, you can apply the same thing. You can apply compassion. You see, some people say,
and you don't lose anything.
No, you gain everything.
Mm-hmm.
In compassion, you gain everything. Everything in life is a challenge. Without challenges, without problems, life will cease to exist.
Right.
People don't know that. Not in general. They say, I want to get rid of all my problems. I don't want somebody to attack me. I don't want somebody to challenge me. Be grateful when somebody does, because without that, we wouldn't grow. Without an attack, without a challenge, without a problem, life wouldn't even go forward. Because, see, life isn't fixed in symmetry. It's asymmetric. There always has to be a need for life to move forward. It's flow. It's like water. If there's no place for the water to flow to, it becomes stagnant. And so life can't survive stagnant. It needs to be in a constant evolution. And so, and it's got eternity to do that. There's no end to it. Mm-hmm. It's got an infinite field of possibility to draw off of. So that's never going to end. So when a problem comes along, like somebody attacks me, mm-hmm. I can address that and say, you know, this is my challenge in the moment. And so instead of resisting the attack, I can become present to it and say, I'll look at it. I can see it. Okay, and if I see it fully without resisting it, I can feel it. And if I can feel it in the presence of my own heart, and I can and have that kind of sincere willingness, not to try to fix it, but to be with it, and I continue to listen in its presence without resisting myself, mm-hmm. my own nature in any way. And your nature, by the way, is illumination. Something comes
our
up.
Our nature is illumination.
Your pressure. Nature is, yeah. And so if I was to actually say, you know, I can hold my awareness in the presence of that, what will happen is something extraordinary. Something will speak up through your feeling and say, it's not this, my dear. You don't have to take this as an affirmation of who you are. You don't even have to defend yourself.
Right.
See, you're only getting...
So defending kind of locks it in, doesn't it?
It does.
Self-esteem.
The moment somebody attacks you and you defend yourself, you're caught. You're in the loop. Imagine if you didn't have an identity to defend.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody said something to you, it means nothing. Somebody attacks you, it means nothing. It's their problem, not yours. You have nothing to defend.
I loved it when you said, somebody says, this is your stuff, and you said, what did you say to that? It's your stuff, and then you think you're, I remember you saying, no, it's not. None of it's my stuff. Take it back. It's all, it's
that's right.
All...
That's right.
It's such a change. We're all used to saying it's my stuff.
Yeah, as soon as you get blamed with something, you can say, it's like you can, in compassion, you can feel that. You can look at yourself and say, is this real or isn't it? Not through trying to analyze right or wrong, but just be through purely being aware and feeling it. You know, people say we don't have a map. We do. We have our hearts. Now, our hearts can be misguided.
Mm-hmm.
If we're attached to something or if we have an aversion to something, we can lie to ourselves to try to get ourselves to feel happy. But there's something that goes beyond happiness. There's this essential presence and a kind of peace that gives us a kind of bliss if we stay still enough to listen to what really is. And say, it's the first, I think...
So it's like no reaction, is that it?
No, there is a reaction. But the reaction is more of like, instead of a no, it's a yes.
Mm.
It's like... You open yourself up to the possibility of the moment. What is this that has come into my life at this moment? What has this brought me? This can be the simplest thing from an attack to a serious illness.
Mm.
We can't heal, we can't grow until we at least acknowledge innocently the moment and don't try to turn it into something else.
Mm-hmm.
See, if we try to turn it into something else, we're really entertaining illusion that we somehow can shape the universe to our will. A lot of people believe that.
That's actually pretty fashionable right now.
It's very fashionable.
Mm-hmm.
It's all this goal orientation.
Mm-hmm.
What if instead of trying to say we know what we want, we say I'm willing to discover what I want. I'm willing to listen. See, we have this essential underlying perceiver, and then we have all our little individuated incarnations running around in this world, kind of like, I don't know what I want because I can't see on the level of this unified field of oneness.
Mm-hmm.
I can only perceive what's going on in my life. What if we gave that up, of trying to say, I know, and just open ourselves to a place of saying, I'm listening.
Mm-hmm.
Because life, just the whole concept of oneness implies there is only one. Only one. And if there's only one that is orchestrating this, then the parts get the benefit of that one. Now, if the part
you're saying the perceiver is the one. It's the reflective of the one.
Yeah, the perceiver is the one.
Mm-hmm.
The perceiver is the face of the universe rolling forward. The intelligence behind it, the divine intelligence that is rolling forward behind it. You see?
Ultimate perceiver is the one.
Well, see...
And gifts us.
Right.
In the most trying situations.
It does. Now imagine if we could just sort of stretch our imagination just beyond our normal limits of thinking and say that the face that is presenting itself as our perceptions is God. Okay? And God or Goddess. God, Goddess, ultimately is aware of its own infinite nature.
Mm-hmm.
But life is where that infinite nature is presented. It comes into actualization. So the infinite nature without life is just sort of an unattributed absolute perfection. But in life...
So the attributes are our keys to our evolution into enlightenment.
Yeah, because, in wholeness, we have perfection. The shine of perfection is the order that presents itself in life. So we can trust that, because it's coming from the One. And it's actually coming from the One into the One. It's like the One is receiving information of itself through you, through me, through six billion other people on this planet, all at the same time. So in the deeper part of the East, they call that dharmi. I say there's a purpose for our whole world. And you know the purpose inside of you.
The collective purpose.
The collective purpose. And it's not much different in you, because you're a fractal of the collective. Mm-hmm. You're an individual that has within you everything the collective has within it, because you have the One within you. So we stretch our imagination a little bit beyond, try to get beyond the identity, and we come to this undertone of oneness.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that fractal is experiencing everything on some level that everyone else is, in a transpersonal realm, and also you're experiencing on an individual level. Now, this individual, if you could give up the identity of it and look in towards that, intuit in towards that, feel and listen in towards that unified oneness in a kind of inward gaze and a willingness to capitulate or give in to that higher self within oneself, you're on this spiritual path. It's what's different than just trying to look for things to benefit you in life.
Mm-hmm.
You give in to something deeper.
But I have one more question about that, which is, don't we all have an individual purpose as well?
Absolutely.
And that's also called the Dharma?
That's called Dharma. That's different than Dharmi. Dharmi is collective. Okay. Dharma is individual. Both are of those things are basically karma. Karma. Okay. Karma is action. The
Karma is action?
It is. That's all it really means in the East. A lot of people think it's retribution of some sort. But karma is information. It's the structure of truth unfolding into life. And if we integrate it, it becomes, and we use it without resisting it, without polluting it with our attachments and aversions, it becomes our dharma. It becomes our path, our unique path in life. And if you
wait a second, so karma isn't our attachments and aversions that came from past life experiences,
Our attachments or aversions are the tendencies or the kleshas, the shadows that fall upon our karma.
Mm-hmm.
And those are the things that kind of clog up the wheel of time, clog up the wheel of our own evolution. And we can learn from those, so they don't have to remain a problem. But if we don't learn from them, if we resist them, if we become attached and we say, this is who I am and I'm going to hold on to this, we're going to be in misery for the rest of our lives, because we are a changing form. The universe is never the same from one moment to the next, either are you.
Mm-hmm.
And so if we instead unhook ourselves from this need to be something, instead of trying to draw a conclusion to who we are, we actually enter into a flow. Now, if we can listen for the shine of truth, the illumining power in our consciousness, and honor that, learn to embody it, that becomes our dharma in life. We find our purpose, our unique purpose, which is a piece of the larger purpose, which is the dharma.
Hmm.
See, we are part of something. We can't separate ourselves or out. There's an inherent responsibility to listen for the need in life, because the need in life will present itself. And if we can answer it, we fulfill our dharma. And not only do we fulfill our dharma, we fulfill...
So our dharma comes up through our need in life, that life needs us to present something. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Like I said, life is an asymmetry.
Mm-hmm.
In time, if you were to look at it purely in physics, one moment holds a memory of what it needs, and the next moment arises to fulfill it.
Hmm.
And that's the same thing in our lives. You can see that. As long as there's some place to go for our lives, we're alive. When there's no place left to go, we stagnate.
Mm-hmm.
And in the stagnation, we begin to die. So
the dharma comes up as a need which we want to respond to in order to create ourselves.
Exactly. And if we fulfill that ability to listen for, that means when we listen for, we have to feel for. See, that's what I mean by the map. We have a heart. We can feel for what we're listening for. And this is the technique that everybody anywhere can learn. If you can learn to listen purely, set aside your need to be someone. Set aside your need to be proving yourself or defending yourself. You enter a kind of a place where you could say you have an undefended heart.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have to be undefended to the universe. You just have to be undefended to yourself. And you have to be able to set aside, I have to have. And you always know, I have to have or I have to be, because there's a pressure there. You take a breath and just let the pressure go. Just let it go. Become present to the moment long enough to hear what's going on. What's going on around you? What's happening? You see, because you already...
Kind of a meditation.
It is a kind of
living
meditation.
Meditation.
It's called, in the East, they call that the dhyasamiksha. It's mindfulness. Mm-hmm. Simple mindfulness. Different than vipassana. Vipassana is a kind of reduction into silence. Mindfulness is a reduction into presence. Mm. Of being aware of what is in life. See, the difference between what we have been told enlightenment is
mm-hmm.
and what it actually is simple. We are not going towards an undifferentiated state, not merging into an absolute silence. You know, we already are that.
Hmm.
We are the silence watching life arising through our consciousness. So we don't have to go after that. And if we do, we'll be frustrating ourselves because the eye cannot see itself.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as we're searching for self, we're going to be searching for a reflection. So that's not the purpose. That's not the path in enlightenment. The path in enlightenment is this ability to actually learn how to serve that which is emerging without gunking up the wheel or clogging up the wheel, but instead finding a way to say, what is the highest possible expression of this? How do I get out of the way of it so it finds actualization in life?
Mm-hmm.
The high self in you, the soul self in you, it wants to be in its creation, and it wants to be in the best possible creation. It wants to be in paradise. See, paradise is always here. We have the format. We have the blueprint for it. The blueprint for you in paradise is called the Devata Pratima,
mm-hmm.
the divine image of God. The blueprint of the universe is called the same thing. We're a fractal of that. The divine image of God is everywhere. We are in ourselves, in our own creation.
Hmm.
We created this. We stepped into it.
Hmm.
See? And now if
it's hard to imagine we're in our own creation. I mean, I know that, but
It's a difficult concept because we see everything reflectively.
Mm-hmm.
In enlightenment, you no longer see anything reflectively. You see everything in presence. Mm-hmm. Everything is emerging out of the silence in that moment, and you don't interfere with it. So the moment you receive something, it's already an expression. The moment you realize something, it's an actualization. Our model in the past for enlightenment has been self-realization.
Mm-hmm.
The true model for enlightenment is realize, actualize. It's not leaving life for something else, but realizing life for what it is, that this is the best God can do.
Hmm. So we can take that into our doing.
That's exactly right.
That's interesting. Okay, so this is a lot to digest. So now and now I'd like to ask who Aravinda is, if you would be so kind as to express what it was like as a little person. I know you have incredible sight called Semetica, and I wondered if you had that at birth or childhood.
I did. I was born with Semetica. Semetica to give you just a little understanding what Semetica is. Semetica is an ability to actually be able to kind of look from the root of consciousness into manifest form, into manifest creation. So when you're sitting at the root of consciousness, what you see is everything in its sort of its highest possible state. So when I look at you in Semetica, I see you in your perfection, in your glory, in your light, in your divinity. And then I see the communication that's taking place between there and where you have found yourself, where you believe yourself to be. And I see the communication that's going on, and I can bring forward that communication for you to be able to listen to. You already know what you're communicating, but there's so much noise in the world validity, and also in all of those things that you've been told, been taught, been trained to believe. You know this as a mm-hmm. person that works with consciousness. And those things all interfere with that communication and mm-hmm. because they create slants on what you're hearing. Now, there's no slant in Semetica. It's just silence, listening, to the breath of God forming you. And it's perfect. It's so beautiful.
And you see beings in context with the whole, with the universal whole.
Yeah, that's right. Because from that place, you not only see the one, but you see how you are in relation to everything and everybody.
So how did you handle that as a small person? And did your family encourage it? Did they understand?
No, they didn't. Sadly, as all parents, they love you and they try to do their best.
They want you to be normal.
They want you to be normal. And when you're a child with Semenica, you want to be normal. There's an illusion that when you have something like Semenica, that you know, it's right away you're blessed with this great gift or something. For me, it wasn't a gift when I was a child. I observed it more as a kind of a curse. I wanted to be like everyone else. I wanted to be able to close my eyes when I didn't want to see something. I wanted to be able to.
You close your eyes and see better, probably.
Instead, you see better. You hear things. You can understand the fundamentals of people's consciousness forming into that complexity that they've created within their minds. And you know, as a small child, before you've matured your wisdom, that's difficult to digest. Mm-hmm. I spent a great deal of my childhood resisting what I was seeing. And
so you were watching people create their own problems.
Anger.
Tangle themselves up.
Yeah, every problem, you can see almost every problem is an emotion.
Mm-hmm.
Emotions aren't messages from the soul. Emotions are the result of not listening to the messages from the soul.
Mm-hmm.
They're the meters, they're the valves that sit there and say anger, envy, jealousy, greed, all those emotions. Those are all, you know, frustration, depression. Those are all the result of not having listened purely, by having set something up. And when you're a child and you see that going on, you don't really understand it because the wisdom hasn't developed to carry it. And so that lasted for a long time. I found myself actually living a double life. One part of my life was trying to be just like everyone else, being very careful what to say, what not to say. If I saw something that was, you know, extraordinary or out of the ordinary, it would be frightening for people to some extent. And so I learned, don't do that.
Did you have any teachers that you could go to?
Yes, I did. I didn't have any teachers to go to at all. I lived in a very conservative part of the world.
Where'd you live?
Right just north of Portland, actually. Okay. Portland, Oregon.
Hmm.
It's where I grew up until my father died. He died when I was quite young, and then we traveled a little bit to Europe and then came back. Now I do almost all of my work in Europe. We have quite a bit going on over there. We have doing a lot of seminars, big lectures. We have council of people that are working to help the world in a variety of different teams, everything from trying to bring hospitals and schools to underprivileged areas in the world, to things like simply trying to bring balance back to nature, bring education, spiritual education to people around the world.
And we want those to develop here. Just before we go to that, I'd like to hear what happened to bring you forward into the world using your gifts as a young person who was trying to resist it or for his own protection.
Yeah, well, what happened was up until about 20 years ago, I decided to get into the spiritual service of humanity. I found myself really drawn, trying to. I learned as much as I could about physical healing, mental healing.
Did you go to university?
I did for a short while, but it wasn't really where I learned anything. I found that I was always running into sort of a ceiling, a cap. Because, you know, modern psychology, for instance, was something I was really attracted to, but it has a egocentricity. Everything revolves around the ego and the mind, and I realized that's a closed model.
Mm.
And I realized something deeper. And a lot of my teachers agreed with me, but you learn the model of the day if you're going to graduate from school. I quit school before I was finished and found myself more to move into a spiritual search. And eventually, you know, by the time I was 19, I opened my first school.
Oh, wow. Good for you.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. I was teaching.
So you had courage still. You had a lot of inner beingness that
passed
your resistance.
Yeah. It'd be nice to say I was courage. I think it was innocence more than courage. I didn't really see the challenges.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I did my first school, then my second. I opened a big herb healing thing in my little school where I was able to pass on medicinal things using my Semenica side. I didn't have to train myself on a lot of the healing arts. I do that today.
Hmm.
I give a great deal of support to health practitioners in Europe that are in contact with me all the time. If they really have a difficult situation where they don't know how to heal somebody, they'll call on me and I'll work with them a little bit and we'll find cures for things.
So when you said in Europe they're doing service in hospitals and so on, how is that working?
Well, they're not actually doing services in hospitals. What we're trying to do is bring forth, we were working on a program recently up until the Maoists took over in Nepal to bring in some schools and hospitals to the poor, the people that don't have any of that. And Nepal is probably the poorest country in the world. And so we were trying to make some connections there, working with other organizations to raise funds to bring, possibly do seminars there in the Himalayas where we could actually bring in some, take the proceeds from that and then establish, you know, support. That's that kind of thing we were trying to do there. But it's just one piece of, we have about seven different teams working on different things. And the undertone of all of that is spiritual training and teaching. And, you know, it's different. It's not religion. It's spiritual. Getting everyone to discover their own connection to the divine.
Well, it's very exciting to study with you, and I've just begun, but I'm pretty excited about it. But you bring ancient Eastern wisdom into the hands of people like me who are real people that are
exactly.
not necessarily going to go live in the East. So I'd like you to talk a bit about, you started to talk about how in Germany or in places like
Switzerland, Germany, Austria, this is where most of our work is right now.
Mm-hmm. And why is it there rather than here?
It just seemed to evolve that way. Mm-hmm. My mother was German, and so I spoke German when I was a small child. And then I met somebody that came from Germany, and she got very excited and invited me over. And then it just organically, it just developed. It caught on fire, and it just started expanding more and more.
So you're doing your teaching seminars, but you're also having a teacher's program, right?
A teacher's program, yeah. And the teacher's program lasts for years, actually, because we do 10-day program trainings. We call them intensives. The amount of information and knowledge, really, and the patting myself on the back, I'm just saying it the way it is. It's extraordinary. It's perhaps the deepest, broadest body of spiritual knowledge that can come together, that can support somebody that I know of.
And the source of it is your Semetica, is your being able to see and know?
In a way, you would say the source is my Semetica, but my Semetica is more like a tool.
Mm-hmm.
I use my Semetica to be able to extract ancient temple knowledge, to use it to look into things that are lost. And the real source of it is that there's a lineage, an ancient lineage of knowledge, perhaps the oldest lineage of knowledge in the world, which would, in the East, the deepest part of the East, where, when I refer to the East, I'm not referring to the surface East that we see today. I'm talking about the deep spiritual East. The term would be Akarka Div, Paramapada Devapata, or the Sura Vamsha, the difficult to understand Sanskrit terms, but they refer to a never-ending tradition of illumining power that has been handed down from master to master, master to student, and so on, for tens of thousands of years.
Never-ending.
Never-ending. That's what Paramapada means. And I tap into that quite a bit. And so a few years ago, in 2006, I actually ventured into the East, into the Himalayas, and connected with the actual source masters of that knowledge.
What prompted that journey? Was it an inner?
It was actually when I was a little child, when I was 6 years old, I was experiencing, because of my openness and my sight, quite a few attacks at night. And they were severe. It was like, I guess in the West, we don't really always understand. Sometimes we think they're just nightmares children are having, but sometimes they're not. And in my case, it wasn't. My awareness was open to an Akash, or what's called the Navagana Akash field, is sort of this field of awareness that rests sort of in an ethereal realm, just as a sort of a membrane of this world. And that's where we have our connection to the astral worlds. And this astral world is an energetic world. In the synergetic world, there's the upper aspect of it, it's the shining, bright part of it, and then there's a lower part of it, it's sort of the shadow.
Mm.
Between shadow and light, this world exists. And the influences of upper and lower are always here, influencing us. And when I was a child, I had been attacked quite a bit. It was frightening for me. I had no one to talk to about, no one that understood me, and everyone thought it was just a fantasy. Mm. But it was so severe that I wasn't sleeping at all anymore, and I was getting ill. I was starting to, you know, have nosebleeds on a regular basis. So finally, I was just in this place where I gave up, and then one night I woke up and there was this being standing in my room.
Hmm.
And that was my first connection to my teachers. He was
it's
physically there.
It's interesting you say you gave up. I'm going, isn't that part of what we're trying to learn?
It is exactly part of it. Yeah. I think until we stop defending ourselves in this world and start listening for the possibility, our healing in this planet won't really begin.
Right.
It's some of that. We see traces of it now.
So who was standing there?
Actually, the person that was standing there was who I refer to now as Master Amir Ra'amat Kalarohan. And I met him in the Himalayas when I went on this journey in the year of 2006, the summer of 2006. I took a few months and I traveled there on faith. I didn't know for sure how I would go there. I used my Semetica to find my way into the mountains.
But and you were prompted by Semetica, by your sight, to know that there was someone to meet.
Well, about 25 years ago, I was in India, and I was invited. I was in a market, just this buzzing market. You know, if you've ever been in India, it's loud and crazy. And I was buying this Tibetan jacket, and I was bartering for it from somebody. I was completely engrossed in the color and smells. And I felt this hair standing up on the back of my neck, and I just spun around, and there was this man that was walking towards me. He was taller than all of the other Indian people that were in there, the wall-to-wall people, and shoulder to shoulder. And he was walking. He must have been, about 100 feet away when I spotted him, and he was looking directly at me, and he was walking towards me. And it was miraculous. It was like a sea parting. These people just sort of parted, and this path was formed right to me.
Oh, wow.
You know, it was quite extraordinary. And what's even more extraordinary, people weren't even aware they were doing it. And he was walking along, he had this stick, and he was wrapped in sort of a purple dhoti, you know, sort of a wrap. And he walked right up to me, and I looked him in the eye, he looked me in the eye, and he said, "Are you ready now? Are you ready to come home? Are you ready to come home?" And I didn't, you know, it took me a moment to just get my presence, because at first, you know, I wasn't sure who this was. But when I let go, just for a moment, something happened. It was as though time stood still, and I looked and I knew this was one of the masters. Mm. It was as though a memory, it's like a skin falling off and a time revealing itself.
Wow.
And there was this memory of these beings, and he was asking me. And at that moment, I just felt into it, and it was just, no, I'm not ready yet. And just patiently said, "Very well, then later." And he walked off. And I knew who this was, and it didn't happen again.
How did you know, just to enter? And just
it's as though all of the seeing, all the memory comes back. Mm-hmm. Some of us experience that sometimes in our lives. And perhaps you meet somebody, and you see them for the first time, and you go, I've known this person forever. But it's not just that. Something stops. You know, it's as though, you know, creation opens for a moment and something eternal happens. You've known this person forever.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and maybe some of the memories instantly appear if we don't have any resistances to the moment. In that moment, all the memories seem to reappear. And, you know, afterwards I questioned myself, why didn't I go? Why didn't I do that? You know, and I realized I just wasn't ready. You know, something inside of me.
It took 25 years to get ready?
In a way it did. You know, for the next 25 years, a few years passed by, and then about...
By then you're already teaching?
Well, about 15... Well, I've been teaching my whole life, mm-hmm. but I have spent most of my life trying to avoid attention.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a bit of a recluse, and I like my quiet, and I don't like demand. I don't like pressure on me. I don't like people to think that I can give them something when I realize my intention in life is to try to get people to realize they have it all.
Mm-hmm.
And just help them find their way to tap into it. And I don't like the possibility of projections that happen when you have something. Like Semetica is
so
not...
We want to make you our hero.
Something, you know, and I found that people do that. And what I really wanted was what I learned from when I was really young. I just wanted to be like every child does, wants to be loved, to feel normal. And when you're an oddball, or you're different because you see something,
yeah.
then you realize you feel you fit out of it, so you make your adjustments. And so I created a kind of a clandestine life all the way up until about 15 years ago.
Mm.
Even though I did all my spiritual teachings, I did counseling, I did healing work, that was my life. But 15 years ago, I started to feel every time I offset something, there's a kind of challenge to this truth meter inside of me. It says, you know, you're not being completely truthful. You can't fully own your consciousness until you're willing to step fully into the light of who you are. and embrace
That's
your
Dharma.
That's
the commitment you talk about.
It's the kind of commitment I've talked about. Without that commitment, we don't get it.
Mm-hmm.
If we're on the fence in life, if we're always on the fence, we never really get it. You know?
What does the commitment look like for people who are listening?
It's a folding in. Into oneself. It's a willing to say, I give up my defenses. I'm willing to stand naked in the presence of God. You know,
So you did that in a kind of a moment ritual ceremony.
I did that in a moment, and then I had an incredibly deep vision of the oldest of the masters that is living in the Himalayas. And it was at that moment I knew I would see him.
Hmm.
And that deep vision was extraordinary. It was perhaps the biggest and most important vision of my life. And it took me about another 15 years, believe it or not, before I actually had another extraordinary vision where I was in a 40-day personal silent retreat. I was doing silence and I was meditating all day and fasting and eating very purely, drinking a lot of water. I was in the forest, a place that I had picked out that was I thought was very beautiful and all the qualities of nature that we so love. And I was in this deep vision and I saw one of the masters appear to me. And there wasn't much. There wasn't anything said. It was just what was somehow transmitted to me through that moment. And I knew I had to go. So I went home and I went and talked to my wife and I said, I'm going now. I have to go. And I knew it was going to be something that was going to take me to the edge of my life. I knew that I was going to have to ride my faith on this one. Because I had no map. No guides. I just made myself ready. Got my passport, flew to India, made my plans. I was going to plan going up through one particular area. I was going to go through Sikkim. I ended up going through another because the Sikkim was flooded out. But, you know, the interesting thing is the moment I arrived in my hotel in India, I received a letter from a holy man from the masters.
Oh, wow.
And they had sent it. They knew where I was going to be. They knew the place that I was going to arrive in India and where I was going to be staying for the first few days. This letter would have to have been thought out ahead of time. And I read the letter, and it sent me in this very unusual direction. It sent me in the opposite direction that I was originally going to go. And I realized later it became a part of their will that I would remember a student I'd had from a former life, Krishna Lila, who I met on that journey. In a desert ashram.
Wow.
Yeah, perhaps one of the biggest challenges of my life happened there. I was confronted in a cave. I was by this very dark spirit on the journey because I was traveling through the desert on camel, actually, with a young boy who was a camel boy, and he was in my care, and JJ, that's what his name was. I asked him what it meant. He just said, just JJ, sir. He didn't know what it meant to himself, I don't think. And his camel, Billy, he was obviously enamored with Western, but he was one of the most beautiful children I've ever encountered in this life. That's one of the things I loved about India is the innocence of the country children.
Hmm.
And he became my guide through the desert, and we found the ashram of Krishlila, and I knew it instantly. I knew instantly who he was. But before I got there, I had entered into...
He was a teacher, your student from a past life?
He was a student of mine from past life, and he recognized me, even before I recognized him.
So that was part of your journey to the masters?
It was part of that. It was a remembering of that life, because it turned out that 300, according to these masters, and according to what I could actually gain from my own returning of memories, is that 300 years ago, I lived there in these mountains. And I left there on this sort of mission that I felt, you know, but it was also a reaction to things that that happened there that caused me to want to respond to doing work in the world. And so after a few lifetimes and this lifetime, it was like coming full circle for me. So arriving back.
So you made a commitment 300 years ago to be in the world and do this kind
of
thing. Yeah.
And so... most of my memory of that returned on that journey. I was confronted on the way there by a very, very dark spirit that could have ended my life and JJ's life in this dark cave that we were sleeping in. We're going to make our resting spot on the way to Krishna Lilaji's in this cave in the desert. And it called up all of my limitations from my childhood and put me centrally into being willing to give up my own life. So JJ represented myself in that moment. And
the boy.
So I forgot myself. All I thought about was defending him. And it wasn't planned. It just happened that way. In the moment when that happened, everything came back. And I was protected in the situation, and I was able to overcome it.
So, but you had to be undefended yourself and defend the boy.
At the same time, but in a way, it never turned into violence. It's just this darkness just left.
Hmm.
He was...
And that can happen for all of us.
I think inevitably on our journey into our awakening, we are all confronted by our greatest fear.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we can achieve that without that. And our greatest desire.
Mm-hmm.
It's between our fears and our desires that we are limited. Until we transcend those, I don't believe that we can ever be really free.
Mm.
And both of those occurred in that particular journey. It was really a culmination and completion. I mean, I had already been teaching. I already achieved a kind of freedom in my consciousness that allowed me to see and do whatever I needed to do in this world and bring this knowledge forward. But there was something more. There was a kind of completion that had to happen in the return to that place. It's like it's a full cycle.
And then we only have a few more minutes, so I want to see that we get to the masters. And
okay, so what I did was from there I went north after meeting Krishnalaji, mm-hmm. and he knew where I was going, but he always wished he could go there. He'd heard of these legendary beings, but he's never known them. And they call them legendary, and this is the extraordinary thing, and I haven't said this yet on this particular recording, is that these are amartyas.
Hmm.
And amartya is what we think of in our world as mythical. Because amartya means immortal. But in that part of the world, the idea of immortal represents someone who has conquered death, someone who has overcome and can laugh at the face of death because they're no longer bound by it. They're not just enlightened. They're not just masters, but they are completely and entirely free. There's six of these beings that actually exist on our planet today.
Hmm.
They work quietly behind the scenes. They work quietly in our lives for humanity, and they've been doing this for thousands of years. And I was drawn to that.
They work quietly to move our consciousness, to help us out of our
constantly.
Traps.
They've said repeatedly, say, where the people are sincere and ready for their awakening, they're working with them. And they could be in your life, and you may not even know it.
Hmm.
They could be there at any moment, and you may not know that. We have so much help in the process of awakening. There are our friends, our masters, our guides. They're all in our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And these beings are standing at the top of creation in this world.
Wow.
And there's five of them. I mean, six of them. And so they're...
So you weren't really privileged as much as you were brought into the fold to activate more.
Yeah, it allowed me to be able to affirm what I've been bringing forward for the last... for my entire life, which is this very high temple knowledge, very, very powerful techniques that people can use to bring illumination, to be able to become so present and so aware of their own divinity that eventually it bursts forth as their reality.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed the affirmation. I needed to have it affirmed that because I was bringing things that were really only meant for the very high initiates in temples, I'm giving it to the world, you
mm-hmm.
see. And so there's always a question mark behind that. Is this the right act?
Is this the right thing I should be doing?
Even though my intuition kept saying yes, of course, you know, my mind, you know, is doubting Thomas. It's just, the mind is always a little beast, you know, it's always a little monkey that's causing trouble. Even in the most illumined states of awareness,
yeah.
The mind is always spinning its stories. And so in the background, I was feeling this idea of, well, you know, I really would like to quell that. And when I got there, it happened. When I arrived, Master Amir met me on the journey. But not until I had gotten to the point when I was climbing through the Himalayas, where I had gone through boundaries that I was not supposed to. I'd crossed illegally through borders. I had I was at my end, literally. I there was nothing left in my physical being that said I could go any further. I had stretched my faith to the limit. I hadn't seen a sign of them. I had spoken to remote people in remote villages, some of them who had actually said they'd heard of these beings, but nobody knew. And I just kept following. I just kept going. And there were little signs, little indications. Sometimes, you know, I would be in the mountains just sleeping between boulders, looking at the mountains and the stars all by myself. But I knew I was on my way there.
You didn't ever lose your faith. Even
not
in the trial.
Not once.
Wonderful.
It was at that last point. I was leaving a very remote village, a village that had never seen a Westerner before. And it was on my way out of that village. I'd been traveling about a half a day that I realized I'd hit the point of no return. If I didn't find them, I wouldn't return. Because I was too far out into these remote mountains.
Thought you might die or something?
I knew I would if I didn't achieve it. And something happened to me. I knew that I did what I had to do. And at that moment, I actually, something so magical. It's like a dream. It's like a story. I heard the flute of Master Amir. He was playing his flute in the mountains. Hmm. And I followed it. I didn't know who it was because I had been told there were bandits in these mountains. You know, that I had to be very careful.